Welcome, everyone, to the Pop Culture Podcast by Fantastic Geek. My name is Matt, and joining me, as always, is Grand Moff Tarkin Pete. Hello, Pete.
I prefer Master Jedi Pete. Matt,
well,
how are you?
You know, Pete, I thought all of them were, gotten rid of at the end of the third movie. But what are we talking about today? Are the Jedi back? Have they started to begin to spark to return?
Well, Matt, today we are taking a special look at the pilot, the series premiere, what is also in some places being referred to as a one-hour movie, for Star Wars Rebels, a new TV show that will be appearing on Disney XD and Disney Channel 2. It's quite nebulous and in motion is the future Yoda stuff. Yes.
Well, Pete, yes, it's Disney XD, which is its own channel. I believe that's kind of a brand more towards kind of the hip cartoons. I think you kind of go
extreme cartoons.
That's right.
Matt.
They're extreme.
Yes.
It's a brand of children's TV channels targeting young males. That's the Disney XD thing.
Yes, and previously I had watched, they did a digital cartoon continuing with the Tron series, Tron Uprising, which only lasted one season, but that was my only experience with Disney XD to this point.
Side note, Tron Uprising was going to be a big hit right after the movie was a big hit, and the second thing didn't happen, so the first thing didn't happen. Yeah. But we're talking about something hopefully much more successful, Pete. Can you give us a little bit of background on what Star Wars Rebels is?
Yes. As mentioned before, this is a digitally animated cartoon, a successor to, I think we can relatively say, the successful Clone Wars series, which aired on Cartoon Network for five seasons. Beginning in 2008, a sixth season, a truncated sixth season, was produced and native at this point to Netflix, where all of the episodes can be seen at this point. Star Wars Rebels represents a break from the prequel, idea at this point, which Disney and Lucasfilm are very much distancing themselves from as we are headed towards episode 7 and the sequel trilogy as it is being referred, not to mention separate spin-off films that will be character dependent. Star Wars Rebels takes place between episodes 3, Revenge of the Sith, and 4, A New Hope, the original Star Wars from 1977. In fact, the closest we can pin it is that it takes place 14 years after episode 3. So sometime after the Clone Wars as well.
So does that mean 5 years before A New Hope?
I think it's a little bit longer before New Hope. I know there are a number of timelines laid out. I don't think it's that close to A New Hope.
I was just using, as famed thinker Pierce Hawthorne once referred to it as, the Wikipedia, which does say 5 years. But Pete, I'll trust you over it. So Pete, just so I understand here, what you're saying is that Star Wars Rebels is a sequel to the prequel trilogy and a prequel to the original Quell trilogy.
Yes.
Okay, and therefore also kind of a proto-prequel to the sequel trilogy.
A prequel.
It's easy to figure out.
Yes, yes. Basically, it is new content, and what this represents, Matt, this is the first content produced that we have seen under Disney since the purchase. Yes, it was kind of thought up before Lucasfilm was sold to Disney in a $4 billion purchase 2 years ago, October. However, this is the first thing to come out And technically, it's not even out because what we did, we watched the super sneak preview here. This is available right now as of the time that we are recording on Sunday, September 28th. On the Disney XD app for free. Be careful when you watch it. You cannot pause it, fast forward, or rewind, which I found a little bit frustrating. But you can watch it there. It's going to air for the first time on Friday, October 3rd on the Disney Channel. And then the series proper will air on Disney XD beginning Monday, October 13th.
And it's also available at StarWars.com and also the Disney XD. I guess the proper word is app on Apple TV. And all of that requires you to log in with your cable provider info because they're not giving it away for free. It's free to those who already have paid the toll at the toll plaza of Great God Cable. Pete, one quick question for you, and I know you know the answer, and I think everybody probably is clear on this, but given the great canonical kerfuffle where Lucasfilms took so much of the expanded universe and the different layers of comics and role-playing games and novels and anything and everything and kind of washed it all away, am I correct in saying we now add Star Wars Rebels to the list of canon, which is the six movies plus three more on the way and Clone Wars? It is those six movies, that one series, plus Star Wars Rebels that make up the official canon. Is that correct?
Yes. There was earlier this year the establishment of what's known as the Star Wars Story Group, and to some controversy, the splitting of the universe. This counts, this not so much. There's been so much that has been written, that has been produced since these stories came into being in 1977. And, it kind of got unwieldy. And now that we're moving forward with episode 7, which is in the very final stages of filming right now in London, and the idea that these stories are going to continue on the big screen and there's going to be even more of them than ever, as, I think we really all had to figure that would happen. When I saw episode 3 in 2005 at 29 years old, that was the unofficial demarcation of my childhood. Okay, Star Wars is over, move on. And then, I don't know how we could have ever been so silly to think that was going to be the end. And of course it's not. And there are more stories to tell. I think there are great stories to tell. And it's going to continue, which is excellent. But they kind of had to get their house in order in terms of what counts, what doesn't, especially when they're going to continue the stories, when the stories had been continued in novel form and comic book form and video games and every other little niche of content that you can think of. So when they go to do the Boba Fett movie in a couple years, which is not announced, but it's basically announced, are you going to use all the Boba Fett stuff that's come before? No, you're going to go in a separate direction. Okay. Everything with Han and Leia and the family they had in the books and everything, are you going to use that in the movies? Well, it remains to be seen what they're going to use, if anything, other than the idea that Han and Leia might be married and have kids. So, they get to pick and choose. I get that. But they did kind of have to get it under, control in terms of what was going on and say what counts. There's a lot of speculation that there are seeds in Star Wars Rebels for episode 7. Again, remains to be seen until we see that December 18th, 2015. But in the meantime, I'm really glad to have fresh content, especially since the Clone Wars, I think we can say, ended too soon.
Absolutely. And I think it's my layperson understanding, and Pete, you certainly are a much bigger Star Wars fan than I am. I certainly appreciate the movies. I've seen them tons of times, et cetera, et cetera. But it to you, it's got that, you know, Star Wars is that place you go home to your childhood in your mind. Whereas for me, maybe it's, you know, more Star Trek. The, you know, the high quality of Clone Wars, I think, it makes it a little difficult to settle into this pilot. And I don't mean that as a criticism against the pilot. I think that's true for any, you know, kind of continued story. You know, I mean, let's use Star Trek as the example for a second. Were there people who are like, hey, what's with this foppish British guy who's all like, let's be nice, and by the way, oui, non, non, I'm from France. How about get Bill Shatner to just punch some people in the, you know, in the chin, and then go like take a lady back to his room for discussion? It's difficult to kind of get that, you know, get what has come before, you know, washed out of your mouth, so to speak. Given how excellent the Clone Wars were, you know, it was something that was in the back of my mind the entire time watching this episode. Then you add to the fact that that they just simply have to be different. They have to be different, and this is a starting of a new story, and you need to leave all of, you know, all of the previous stuff behind. It made for an interesting experience.
Definitely, and, you know, reflecting back on the beginning of Clone Wars, which, you know, people were really shaky about, okay, we're 3 years out from the final prequel. Now we're going to go back and fill in the gaps between episodes 2 and 3, and we know how the story ends and everything like that. But, you know, I think it's increasingly difficult to look back on the Clone Wars and not say that they were the best thing to come out about the prequels. You know, 99% of the Clone Wars happen off screen. And I think that was a failure of the prequels. As much as I like the prequels, and I really like the prequels. So, you know, there was some trepidation. And, you know, I'm going to talk in a little bit about my trepidation towards this series. But seeing the Clone Wars movie in theaters when it came out, and seeing it twice, actually, the first was a very negative experience in which the projector was very poorly lit. And, you know, we were basically told by the theater staff to just stick it out, and we're giving you tickets for another time, and that's it. So wow. That was a very negative experience. And the second time I saw it, you know, was just so, so much better and took so much more away from it. So I think that tells the story in terms of these need to be viewed under the proper circumstances. And I'm going to illustrate that again when we get to talking about this pilot. But, you know, this is not a new idea for this set of stories, the overarching Star Wars brand, if you will. And clearly, they feel they have stories to tell. And again, I really want to say that this series, beyond telling the stories, serves a dual purpose in that it's to get all the nostalgia in line back for the original trilogy to then slingshot us forward for 7, 8, and 9 starting in December of next year.
Well, Pete, I think that's a good jumping off point to really start to get into the pilot. My experience in watching the Clone Wars movie, which I saw on Netflix when it came on, and you recommended, and you said, oh, this series is so great. I remember just sitting through the 90-minute movie going, oh, geez, this is, you know, essentially the first 3 episodes. I got like 120 more of these. What have you gotten me into? But it takes, you know, it finds its steam, or you start to grow in the characters or whatever it might be. Perhaps going back to watch that movie would be different, knowing kind of how I appreciate the series as a whole now. But then, you know, back we are again with Star Wars Rebels. As I was watching the pilot, I kept thinking to myself the degree of art direction and detailed minutiae that the Clone Wars has. I was concerned whether it would be there in Star Wars Rebels. 4 shorts have been previously released in the lead up to the series starting. One of those shorts was a scene right out of the pilot. And watching that on YouTube, watching that scene and then watching it on Apple TV, on my big TV, the quality is just the animation quality is better than I thought. I still do have some concerns that maybe the production value and the art direction isn't what it was for Clone Wars, and perhaps that's a financial thing, since it's not kind of Lucasfilm by itself saying, hey, Cartoon Network, you want our really awesome content, let's talk to a deal. Since this is all essentially in-house under Disney, maybe they're, I suspect we're going to hear, hey, this is under 85% of the budget that Clone Wars was per episode or something like that, because I just feel there's a little less dressing to the scene, a little less, you know, muck in the corners, a little less, you know, half-ripped graffiti and poster in the background, those sorts of things. Maybe some of it is setting. I don't know. I mean, obviously, when you're on Coruscant, and there's going to be tons of that kind of, you know, riffraff stuff. Whereas when you're on the unpopulated planet of
Lothal.
I mean, that's obviously meant
to be. Correct your pronunciation. It is Coruscant.
Coruscant. Pardon me.
By the way, but Matt, I have to differ a little bit. I think the design aesthetics here are spot on. I think it's all intentional, and you know, we talk about, you know, what it looks like, and that's so important in a visual medium when we're talking about a movie universe gone cartoon, okay? And what worried people with the Clone Wars was, oh, here's this stylized animation, okay? R2-D2 doesn't have straight lines. He's got, you know, some angles. That upset people initially. They came to largely embrace that. With this, there's a little bit of an edge to the design in terms of attitude. You know, whereas the Clone Wars had a glorious, you know, World War II-ish feel to it with the way that they decorated the, you know, the gunships and the spaceships and really made you feel of that era. You know, here there are propaganda posters and things like this. You know, we're going to look at the characters in a moment, but you know, some of the characters have some extreme things going on there. And again, this is aimed towards children first, as the Clone Wars was. And there were kids who aged out of the Clone Wars. You figure you got kids when they were 8 years old, they were 13, 14 by the time the series ended, they were moving on. But guess who's going to be in the seats for the sequel trilogy in a year? Those kids. And there are kids today, kids, teens, and early 20-somethings who grew up with the prequels, and they feel as passionately about those movies as we felt about Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi back in the day. So if anything, this is smart in terms of what they're doing.
I totally agree, and I think to the credit of Star Wars Rebels, it doesn't feel like it's a kid's cartoon. Now, are there times where those sensibilities might, you know, the childish sensibilities might come to the forefront a bit? Sure. Gee whiz, we're about to talk about characters for a second. Who's supposed to be the us? It's the boy. It's none of the adult characters. I get that. But as I was watching this, I kept thinking back to my early childhood, two cartoons, Tiny Toon Adventures and Tailspin, both of which have either pilot episodes or, you know, TV movies or overarching storyline for the first five episodes that were first presented as a movie, whatever it might be, that had real kind of drama and pathos, or at least so they felt to kid me. And then that's quickly something they don't return to. So I think that kids can stretch up to kind of an adult junior take on things. You know, characters can feel love and loss and, you know, hate and anger as well as positive emotions. Kids can feel that too. And I think Star Wars Rebels captures that so well with its characters, Pete.
I agree. And, you know, you've got to tell at the same time a more accessible tale to start and then take it where you ultimately want to go and what represents a bigger risk. You know, people chafed at the Clone Wars movie, the introduction of Ahsoka, some of the attitude that was present. You know, she refers to Anakin Skywalker as Sky Guy. He's calling her Snips. You know, initially people were very put off by that. By the end of the Clone Wars, if you're not in love with that, you didn't stick around. And if you did, you're in love with it. It was great. And, you know, Ahsoka is a very, very popular character coming from where she started in particular. So to see that, at the same time, she is not in any of the movies to this point. So that remains to be seen, particularly with the revisionist history that Lucasfilm has had in the past. But they're giving you this tale early on with Star Wars Rebels. I think, again, you know, there's that kid accessible stuff, but if they follow what they did with the Clone Wars, where they got into some very complex and nay dark territory, I'm excited about what is to come with these characters.
Pete, who are the Rebels?
Okay, well, beginning perhaps in order of appearance here, we have Ezra Bridger, who is the little boy, the teen, I guess we could say, the beginning of the show for us, native to the planet Lothal. We see him at the start, and quickly we come to understand that his planet is now under Imperial occupation.
He's definitely a very accessible character. I mean, as much as I kind of had a note of denigration earlier in regards to, you know, oh, he's the us, but he's a kid. I mean, is Luke Skywalker any different? I mean, Luke Skywalker by Jedi is, you know, a man. I mean, you might argue Luke Skywalker is forced to become a man after the death of Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru, but like, you know, that even Mark Hamill portrays him differently. But I mean, that kid who comes out and is like, hey, we got to get some things, and can I go play with my power converters? And there was going to be Tashi Station. Whatever teen, you know, age of a teen you want to address to Ezra or Luke, it's the same thing. It's, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. It's the wide-eyed youth. It's not kind of the callous, almost adult that we have in Ezra, you know, with shades of Luke. And a compelling character, especially when you realize early on he's like having a strange sense. I don't mean to sound either Spider-Man or pubescent there, just kind of where it's clearly this force sense that he has that the show is kind of not telling you what it is, and he's a little unclear. So that was nice too, where it's like, oh man, we're back to the Force stuff.
I was very concerned with what I saw early of this show, that Ezra Bridger was Space Aladdin. I think you could really draw some comparisons, and we're going to talk about that in a moment when we connect him with the crew of the Ghost, the rest of our Rebel characters. Particularly with the one clip that I saw where they are, you know, stealing the crates from the Imperials early on. Thankfully, that vibe went away, and I think it would be a total mistake with what Disney does to Disneyfy the Star Wars stuff. We follow and podcast the Marvel Cinematic Universe, both in terms of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., the upcoming Agent Carter, and the Netflix Daredevil show, in addition to all of the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies. If they follow that template with Star Wars and let Lucasfilm do its thing, which it's done, I would argue pretty well, given the lasting influence of these movies and how high-profile a project Episode 7 and the other movies coming out are, I'm going to be fine with that. If they meddle, there's concern. And when I saw this character, I said, oh my God, it's Space Aladdin. And thankfully, that was kind of a head fake, because that went away.
New hope.
Yes.
I'd say that I'd stop singing there. Just quit while I'm ahead.
Yes. Speaking of the rest of our characters, we have, in, again, order of appearance, we have Canon Jarrus, who was voiced most prominently by Freddie Prinze Jr. He's our leader of the rebels. He is also, as we find out later on, although really not a whole lot of secret kept to this, he is a Jedi.
I was surprised, despite the fact that it was shown in the various previews that have been out there, that, you know, there's that iconic moment where he puts the lightsaber together. I was surprised at how wonderfully effective that moment was, even for me who saw it coming. Just kind of that moment within the context of the story, where you're really settling into the idea that, you know, if you have some kind of inkling of a force power, you don't really know what it is. There's no one. This isn't part of the social narrative that there's these people out there who have these powers. Hey, maybe you have these powers. Maybe they'll find you. Maybe, you know, what this is just a completely, you know, the notion of the force is such a completely foreign thing to these people. And all right, he's got this trinket. Hey, I've heard of that laser sword, whatever, dude. And then all of a sudden it's like he stands up, he puts it together, and it's like, wow, there are still Jedi out there. I'm immediately thinking, oh man, maybe we get to see Ahsoka at some point down the line in this series, et cetera, et cetera. We know that obviously Obi-Wan is out there, Yoda's out there. And it's like all of a sudden in that one scene through this character of Kanan, it just was like a thread stitching together the two sides of Star Wars canon, the prequel stuff, including Clone Wars, and, you know, A New Hope forward, and all of a sudden he's there just pulling it all together. And it was just a wonderfully, wonderfully exciting moment.
It cannot be argued that Star Wars is not at its best without the Force. You think of the most iconic moments of the series as a whole, and you think of Luke staring longingly into the twin suns with the Force theme playing behind him. You think of him making the run down the Death Star trench with Obi-Wan telling him to believe in the Force. You think of all those other iconic moments, and it has to be present in this. Again, trepidation. Oh man, we killed off all the Jedi, but surprise, there are Jedi who have survived. And all right, we're gonna go down this path again. It was handled, in my mind, very, very well. We'll look at greater length at that reveal when we talk about the pilot in terms of the plot. Continuing on with our characters, Garazeb Zeb Aurelius, the proto-Chewbacca, if you will. His species was not named in this pilot. The design is actually taken from the Ralph McQuarrie original design for Chewbacca. They just grafted it right onto this character.
Yeah, I thought that certainly was a nice nod to the past, to a character design that almost certainly was unachievable back in the 70s, certainly for the budget they were dealing with. And then to kind of have that character here now also taking place, you know, it was the design before the Chewbacca design. So here we have Zeb in the story before the Chewbacca movies, if you will. But largely
playing a hairless Wookiee in one scene who does the growl, which is a great callback to a callback.
Explain.
Well, he, as I indicated, he was to be the proto Wookiee, so that he's pretending to be a Wookiee briefly.
Got it.
Is just such a great cheeky reference if you're in on it.
Yeah, and I mean, it's, I don't mean to take away from the character to say that he's largely fulfilling the Chewbacca role, but that's okay. He's the strong man. He's a little gruff. also, you know, I mean, you get to see his heart at one point. So, I mean, just another character who's, I mean, you know, his flavor is slightly different from that of the other characters, despite the fact that they're all rebels and, you know, half scoundrel and half fighting for, maybe there's this idea to fight the Empire. But it's certainly a welcome character.
We have Sabine Wren, who wears the Mandalorian armor similar to Boba Fett. And the Mandalorians were a significant chunk of the Clone Wars, so there is a connection there. She is our, you know, kind of our special operative. You know, she works in explosives. She's got an attitude. My concern was that she was going to be Space Poochie. If you know your Simpsons, there is a famous episode where they talk about the Fonzification of a show, particularly when it's trying to appear hip. And what do? They give the Simpsons a dog, a skateboard riding dog named Poochie. And that was my concern with Sabine here. You know, oh, she spray paints and look, she's got, you know, crazy drawings on her armor. And oh, she taps into what is perceived as the coolest outfit and mythos of all of the Star Wars universe with Boba Fett. We'll femitize Boba Fett. We'll give her crazy colored hair. She's extreme. You know, it's almost like she's riding a kayak through a 7-Eleven. That's how extreme she is. But it works. I was surprised how much she's my favorite character, Matt. I like her the most.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fun punky attitude there, and I was going to say clearly she's there for, you know, she's there for girls. She's meant to be, you know, preteen girls are supposed to aspire to be Sabine. But I don't think that any of the characters in this show are designed so duplicitously. I mean, I'm sure some of these discussions were had, but I just feel that, you know, she exists as a fully formed character, younger than the next character we're going to discuss, but, you know, that's okay. I don't think there's any kind of agenda here other than she's from a cool slice of life, and if these guys are the proto-rebellion, then, you know, then we're seeing the former Jedi, the young person who kind of, you know, is kind of from the Outer Rim, who's kind of doesn't really know he's imposed upon. We're seeing all these different people who have been affected by the Empire as we head towards rebellion, and she's a part of it, simply put.
We have Hera Syndulla, who is our pilot of the Ghost. We see her behind the stick for the first time, and she is a Twi'lek. She's got the appendages hanging off her head there. And there is a direct connection to Clone Wars there in that she shares the surname of a rebel from the Clone Wars named Chan Syndulla, from the Ryloth planet, where the Twi'leks were in rebellion from the Trade Federation and the enemies of the Republic.
Wow, very nice catch there, Pete. Obviously, people would recognize that that race from being one of the slave girls in Jabba's palace in Return of the Jedi as well, Pete.
Yes, and Hera, as a little girl, was seen in the Clone Wars. She was the little girl that two clone troopers saved midway through the first season of the show.
Oh, wow.
So not sure if that'll ultimately be explored on this show, but we had seen her before if you had seen Star Wars Clone Wars.
Pete, who else do we have in the cast?
We have a droid he has known on screen as Chopper, but the droid's proper name is C1-10P, which if you look at quickly looks like Chop.
Got it.
The proto, well, not proto, R2-D2 previously existed in this universe, but really an extension of that droid idea, little rougher around the edges than R2.
Yeah, in the short, The Machine and the Ghost, I really got a big kick out of Chopper as a character. There's a little bit more of an attitude to him. You might even say personality. He's a little negative. He's a little down. He's a little like, oh, these crazy people with want me to do this, that, the other. It's just fun. It's a fun addition. If you're going to have a droid like that, which I think you have to have some kind of droid. If you're going to have them not speak English, it's just fun to make him a little grumpy, a little, you know, kind of frazzled at all these, you know, do you want me to go up front to do this or go back to do that? All you people are freaking out. Just tell me what to do. You know, there's kind of a slight sarcasm to him. Chance for the artists to focus on, you know, kind of the performance and not the dialogue and all that. So ton of fun to have Chopper there.
So you would say he was the droid you were looking for?
He, you know, I didn't know that I was looking for a droid, but he's the droid I was looking for. Absolutely. Let's move along.
We've got some bad guys here. Really the only one who gets a name in the premiere movie here is Imperial Security Bureau Agent Kallus.
And it's spelled K-A-L-L-U-S, even though yes. It sounds like the word that means uncaring.
Yes.
I hope it's not going to oppress us with lots of savage names in this one.
And, you know, where I get him, it's in the design. You know, he wears the helmet like a Death Star trooper. You know, it's got some flourishes. He's got this funky kind of beard that doesn't connect underneath his chin, almost as if he's grown it to wear his helmet that has guards on the side of his face. He's a fitting nemesis in this pilot, but as we come to see at the end, he is not the ultimate big bad guy.
He certainly is not. By the way, Pete, I think as I do a quick little search here for facial hair types, this might be a mustacheless Winfield perhaps that he wears. But it is a ton of fun, as you said. The word design is just absolutely what he's all about. Well, at least not he as a person, but he is a fictional character. The fact that the facial hair takes a similar pattern to his helmet, it's almost goofy, it's almost cartoonish, but then you're like, you know what? I bet that there's a guy out there, either in history or in modern day, who does something like that just because, like, I'm always an Imperial Security Bureau guy. Even when I take my helmet off, I'm always that guy looking out for security. It's a nice little affectation of design, and it just works perfectly. And then, as you say, it turns out he's not his own thing. He's got a boss.
He does, as he communicates at the end of these first two episodes lumped together into a quote-unquote movie, the Imperial Inquisitor, a Sith in the service of Darth Vader and the Emperor, who... not getting a lot of him in this episode, that's where I still have my tiniest bit of trepidation heading into the series. I thought he was going to play a larger role in this movie.
I mean, we're only two in. I would expect him to play a large role. I think this was more kind of a to be continued. That was the function of the scene, which is to say to be
continued. Oh, it's a good reveal. You know? It is. And, you know, there's some design things going on there. You know, he's got the Sith eyes. He's got almost a Darth Maul type of, you know, presence. You know, there's some speculation. Could he possibly be in some way either present, linked to the bad guys in episode 7 with some rumors leaking out there? And again, we know nothing for certain at this point until they make some kind of announcements. You know, but I'm going to give him the chance and see where it goes. But you saw his lightsaber, Matt, even though he never lit it.
Now, Pete, if my eyes don't deceive me, and I'm in no way looking at the Wikipedia, wasn't that unique lightsaber design based on an unused concept from the Force Unleashed video game?
I think it dates back even further than that, I think it was at one point connected to Darth Maul with a circular double-bladed lightsaber design before they went with the idea that he would just pinch them off his Jedi victims and use them, and the arms would turn. But that's something we're going to see. Again, I'm a little hesitant until I see it in action and how it comes across. But, you know, I give it the benefit of the doubt and going to let it play out, and we'll see how it goes.
Absolutely.
There's one other character I want to talk about, and I think the thing that Star Wars has been so successful at, and really where a lot of excitement in the franchise lies over, you know, the nearly, what are we, 35 years, 77? We're 37 years into this franchise at this point, is in the gray areas, you know, the bounty hunters and the cantina aliens and things like that. And we do get one of those types of characters named in this premiere. And, you know, fans of the Clone Wars remember Hondo Onaka, in addition to a lot of those bounty hunter types of characters. And the character of Visago in this episode with the horns there, a callback to, I believe it's a Devonian who was in the cantina in the original Star Wars.
Ah, yes.
So, you know, we get a little bit of that vibe here. So, you know, whether he will be the Hondo Onaka of this series, who, if you've not watched the Clone Wars, again, get on that, you know, kind of this Latin type of, you know, gave you a little bit of a con vibe there as well, you know, a lot of flourishes and, you know, never good, never bad, always in between, always out for himself, and wonderfully drawn in the little bit that we did get him. So I'm looking forward to this type of character, particularly when we have, you know, our rebels are on the wrong side of the quote-unquote law with the Empire here.
There's definitely tons of potential ahead for Star Wars Rebels. It's really an exciting, you know, it's been an exciting start.
So in terms of recapping the episode proper, the first thing we're going to look at, let's get the lowdown on Lothal. We have this planet that is, you know, newly under the thumb, although it remains to be seen the passage of time from when Ezra watches the Star Destroyer come over his little, his not so unobtrusive home, which is a giant needle.
It's like he lives in the Space Needle 5 miles outside town by himself.
Yeah, maybe there's a lot of Space Needles on this planet. We don't know.
Maybe they have lax child education laws, and, you know, maybe like non-existent personal income tax or whatever, or property tax, and he's just like, whatever, I moved into the Space Needle, man.
You know, but the citizen that he helps, who's just trying to sell a couple Yogans, man, you know, says, I remember what it was like before the Empire came here. So clearly there's been a passage of time. That or the Star Destroyer arriving really is just a continuation of an occupation and not so much the occupation happening.
That certainly is how I read it, that if anything, it was, you know, references made a little bit later on to, you know, Tarkin kind of cracking down on the Outer Rim.
Yes.
I certainly had the notion, the headcanon, if you will, to use a phrase the cool kids use, that this has been an Empire world since, you know, the founding of the Empire. It's just, you know, more recently the things stink more, you know, that there's been this crackdown. So it kind of hasn't been, oh, gee, like I certainly did not read that Star Destroyer as that's when the Empire came to town or that's when stormtroopers came to town. It was just like, it's like living in a port city. Here comes another naval ship, another reminder that we don't have, here comes the Navy, here comes the Army to kind of keep us in line. And it kind of was more, you know, sigh, here we go again, and not the beginning of something.
And in that context, it certainly makes sense with the Tarkin Town refugees that we see a little later on in the episode. But we quickly get into this street rat, gutter urchin, type of thing with Ezra, where, you know, I saw this scene was one of the little, you know, features, if you will, was a 7-minute chunk that came out. And I got to say that viewed out of context, I was worried. Within yes. context here, really worked. You know, we lay out our rebels, most of them, you know, from Kanan to Zeb to Sabine. You know, once we get on the ship, we get Hera and Chopper. And, you know, this is a cute Robin Hood-esque beginning. You know, although it's not completely apparent right at the start that, you know, first off, we don't know what's in the box and, you know, what their ultimate intention is with the blasters once we find that, but they find one another, they find out about one another here, and Kanan seems to have some kind of inkling through the Force or otherwise about Ezra. But there's some callbacks to the speeder bike chase from Return of the Jedi. In fact, nearly sound for sound, the same effects from Return of the Jedi. And it's much more fun in the ultimate context of this pilot episode.
Yeah, I was a little troubled at how, in that scene and a few others, how the music appeared not just to be derivative, which I would expect it to be derivative of the John Williams body of work, but it almost seemed like it was just, you know, it was the soundtrack. That said, look.
it was, but.
Yeah. I mean, this as a pilot episode, like we've discussed many times before about many topics, whether it's the start of a season or a start of a series, you have to nail down some of this stuff. If you just say, all right, it's science fiction, this kid lives by himself, whatever, he lives by himself in some abandoned thing, great. That frees him up to join a bunch of, like, pirates or whatever these guys are, you know, a bunch of mercenaries, whatever they are that you wouldn't want mom and dad letting you go off to, fine. And this planet, he's allowed to live by himself, et cetera, et cetera. The stealing of, you know, the box, that too, a very compact way to say, well, what are they stealing? Weapons. For who? For people who don't like the Empire. Who are those people? They're future rebels. You know, you're dealing with mercenaries who also don't like the Empire, and gee whiz, where is this series going to end up? Full-blown rebellion. The rebellion against the Empire. So it was surprising how tidy and how inclusive and how it hooked you in, despite the fact that they were doing all those expositionary stuff. And you get a little extra wiggle room when you have a new person, which is why oftentimes stories start with a new person. So you can come up with a really convenient way to say, hello, I'm Hera. My name is Hera, and I drive the thing. This is Zeb. He doesn't like you, and he's a stinky monster. You know, again, they smartly chose to have a new character join an old group of people, even though the group is new to us, because all in this entire section of the story on Lothal, we're being introduced to all these people, you know, while Ezra is being introduced to them.
And I could see where some people are going to watch this and chafe. Oh, and they just got on the new Falcon, and here's new Chewie and new Han and new R2 and new Luke. But it's not that. And, you know, within 10-15 minutes of this pilot, this is closer to the Star Wars of our childhood, of the original three movies, particularly the original movie, when they have the shootout with the TIE fighters and the John Williams-esque, because it's not actually him doing this, score, you know, we're back there. And this is what they want to do to get us ready for those new movies. And it's successful.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to say, well, this is the new Luke and this is the new, you know what, those are archetypes well before Star Wars. You know, we'll trot out the Man of a Thousand Faces.
Hero with a Thousand Faces. Yeah.
What's that?
Hero with a Thousand Faces.
Him too. Yeah, he's a hero, he's a man, whatever it is. I mean, point being, the fact that there's, you know, the guy in charge and the apprentice and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Like, really, I'm not going to waste time saying, well, how similar is Hera to Leia? How about this? Similar if you're going to get caught up by the fact that they're both women. Dissimilar if you look at everything else other than the, you know, the chromosome, you know? Like, so they're completely different, and let's luxuriate in these characters and not get so caught up in, oh, man, the design of the ghost is not 100% dissimilar to that of the Falcon. Therefore, they're taking my childhood away. Like, all right, it's a ship. There's only so many ways a ship can look. You know, let's go. Let's enjoy it for what it is, not do what I think can tug at too many Star Wars fans, and, you know, particularly Star Wars fans, where it's like, this is not like the three movies I grew up with, therefore it is bad.
Right.
Judge it on its own merits, good and bad, whatever it might be, but don't sit and go, you know what, it's unfair that they didn't do The Young Adventures of Luke Skywalker, Tashi Station Power Converter Kid. Like, come on, let's do something new here.
The argument against the prequels was how small the universe was made to seem. You know, R2-D2 and Anakin were connected, and Anakin built C-3PO, and on and on and on. You know, and could you make some form of argument here in light of where this goes with the Jedi holocron, with the message from Obi-Wan Kenobi? Perhaps. But this is its own tale within this larger universe. It's disparate enough. It's distanced enough that it works. And again, you know, the tremendous use of design aesthetics. So, you know, we get through our Millennium Falcon-esque shootout and escape, and they come back to this planet and they're arming other people who need help. And, you know, there are very clear references to Macquarie's work. Again, one of the refugees is, you know, the design that was going to be Han Solo with a headband and a beard. You know, Visago has several droids that were early IG-88 mock-ups that he's using there. And there's even lovingly, as they did with the Clone Wars in season 5, where they used the Walrus Man design that Kenner used in its action figure, that other than being a walrus bore no resemblance to the character in terms of the outfit, with, you know, oranges and blues and things like this. They did it again with the hammerhead, the Ithorian alien there, and made it look exactly like the action figure from the 70s, which was wearing something that was not seen in the movie. So, you know, there's just such a love for the source material here that I think it can't go wrong.
I think that you certainly picked up on some of that stuff that I did not. I did not notice the Walrus Man. I did notice the slight...
Walrus Man was not in this episode. It was the Hammerhead.
Oh, I see.
Yes,
pardon me.
Walrus Man was in the Clone Wars.
Got it. Okay, I take that back for misunderstanding. I did notice the Hammerhead guy, and I was like, oh, that looks a little bit different. And again, the whole time I'm watching this, I'm saying, all right, the animation is less stylized than Clone Wars, which... I came to quickly enjoy Clone Wars. Okay, you're doing something different here. Should I be nervous about that? The edges are a bit more rounded. The fact that they're going with it for whatever reason, design or to ease stuff through the pipeline or cost, fine. You want to make Hammerhead Guy look a little bit different, and in the process make it an homage to something that the Uber fans appreciate. It shows that their hearts are in the right direction for whatever the genesis is of some of these design changes.
When we move to the point in the pilot where we get to, you know, explore the idea of the Force, you know, Ezra finds the holocron. He plays what we instantly recognize as Obi-Wan's message, makes it clear that, you know, where this is in terms of the timing, and that the Jedi are really, really on the run, though we know Obi-Wan's out there, Yoda's out there, Luke will ultimately, you know, come into contact with them. You know, it works. And then, you know, by the time we move to the Wookiee rescue of this, and, you know, Wookiees being so important in the Star Wars universe, and they were explored ever so briefly in the Clone Wars, that's my biggest disappointment in the Clone Wars, is that we never got to the invasion of the Wookiee planet of Kashyyyk, the repercussions of which are in Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, and we see that end. But that was just something I really wanted to get a multi-arc episode, you know, with in the Clone Wars. And good to get him in here. We get some identification with a younger Wookiee character in Kit War. We get the spice mines of Kessel, which, you know, back to the original films had been called out. We finally get to see them. And it's just good stuff, Matt.
Now, Pete, refresh my memory. I'm sure we talked about this when we talked about the Clone Wars hitting Netflix, whenever that was, 6 months ago?
In March, April?
March, yeah. Am I correct in saying that either the assumption is, or it has been said outright, that they stopped doing the Clone Wars because Cartoon Network, which was, you know, which is outside the Disney sphere, the Cartoon Network was the channel for the Clone Wars, and as long as you're doing Clone Wars, it's got to be on Cartoon Network. So that was part of the reason why they shut it down, that it was like, let's take everybody who makes Clone Wars, do something else that's Star Wars, and do it for Disney and keep it all in-house. Am I correct in saying that?
It's just not that simple. You'd like to be able to say this equals this, and that's why that. And it's just not that way. You know, these shows take so much more production, ironically, than, you know, live action TV. And they're that much further ahead than, you know, the broadcasting of this. The pilot here, this was finished in January of this year.
The pilot was?
Yes.
Okay.
And we're seeing it now.
Right.
You know, it's believed there are 16 episodes in this first season. Whether that is going to constitute the entire first season, just don't know at this point. But, you know, they shuttered the Clone Wars. The show had been, you know, running on Friday nights on Cartoon Network, as happens with series over time. Ratings went down. They moved it to Saturday mornings for the final two seasons for 4 and 5. And then it just ended with very little ballyhoo. And, you know, there was still a sixth season far into production and hanging out there. And Matt, you know, we've talked in the last couple of days, you know, Star Wars has recently put up on its website production materials for even more Clone Wars that aren't going to come all together. And again, this larger universe and so much to explore there, but just disappointing that it didn't kind of end on its terms, rather the franchise's terms.
Right. I mean, that's part of the reason, I'm not able to find anything in a quick online search, but I really truly suspect that the Disney purchase of Lucasfilm was a factor, just because, you know, it was like close out the one, whether it was the project, whether it was the relationship with, you know, Warner Brothers owned Cartoon Network, whatever it might be, close out the one, you know, and move on to something new.
Kind of like cut off one head, another takes its place,
that,
maybe?
That as well.
Hail Hydra.
I think too, I mean, I don't know. I was certainly not, I was aware of the Clone Wars movie coming out. I was never interested in seeing the series while it was on. So does that mean that it was mismarketed? Does that mean that I just, you know, had my hands over my ears and somehow didn't get the marketing message? Clearly both of these cartoons are intended for children plus their family. You know, I mean, children first, to be sure. But they want that adult Star Wars audience of any age. They're going for that level of quality. It's not just kind of like, here's another episode where Ahsoka falls down a hole and somebody rescues her. And then next week, R2-D2 falls into a pit. And some, you know, it's not kind of that formulaic of the kiddie cartoon. There's tons of potential here for Star Wars Rebels. I'm really interested to see where it goes in this 16-episode first season and hopefully beyond.
And as we mentioned before, you know, where this premiere works the best is, you know, the scene, the shootout, they're rescuing the Wookiees. And, you know, Kanan says something along the line like, I'm about to let the secret out, which, again, we already knew. But it is a chill inducing sequence where, you know, he walks in the line of fire, very nonchalantly dodges a couple blaster bolts and then puts the lightsaber together. And Agent Kallus says, target the Jedi. That is this show in a nutshell. And that's where I was ultimately sold on this concept.
I read half of an article online that basically took the argument, oh man, I thought Star Wars Rebels was going to be a good idea. Then they had to have Jedi stuff in it. I'm so sick of the Jedi stuff in Star Wars. It's like, do you not understand that that's what the entire original trilogy was about? And then the entire prequel trilogy was about, you know, the story arc of a Jedi.
And yeah, don't tell this guy that, you know, Jedi Luke Skywalker is going to be in the new movie. Don't let them know that at all, or that there will be lightsabers and the Force. And, you know, if we're lucky, some way to get Yoda back somehow or something like that. Like, wow, way to miss the point.
Yeah, so to me, that was just a crowning moment. As I said earlier, it just ties the two halves of Star Wars together, and of course looks ahead to the third half, you know, to the third trilogy that will start soon, where, yeah, there's Jedi in it, there's, you know, these peacekeepers, this faith-based initiative, whatever you want to call it, it's there, and I think it's a welcome addition. The show is stronger having that than just, oh, it's a bunch of, you know, rascals.
The prequels took a lot of hate with the introduction in 1999 in episode one of the midichlorians, of really scientizing the mysticism, the religion. And this, I think, comes closer to the original view of the Force that we had. It distances itself from the midichlorians and, you know, I thought that was a better concept than a lot of other people thought. But again, you quantified something religious. You quantified faith, and I can understand where people had a problem with that. So when you get this, that's where it really comes through, and that's where Star Wars is at its heart. It's believing in yourself, this Force. You know, and where Han Solo can shake it off, and, you know, ancient religions and hokey traditions and things like that. But, you know, it's where the wonder in this universe and, you know, the belief in yourself and, you know, fate and everything comes together. And that's where, you know, it's always worked for me.
What I think is interesting in the notion of midichlorians is when you view the movies in release date order, that the Force moves from something that is purely of faith to something that is very rooted in science. But when you watch the movies in episode order, it moves from something that is science based into, when you kind of remove the science apparatus, it then reverts to something very faith based. And I think that's an interesting discussion to have. I'm not saying to, you know, discuss it in all its entirety here, but I think that's just a really interesting notion of, we have the answers for some things, and then when you take away the answers, you know, the questions can still remain. So, I mean, I don't know. I was never as up in arms over the midichlorians thing as much as other people were as well. But it's nice that we kind of have, you know, again, this kid who isn't identified by science as a forceful person, so it is kind of more in that age of wonder, Pete.
Yeah, and it's difficult with the excellent reveal at the end of my favorite movie of all time, The Empire Strikes Back, of Vader as Luke's father. It's difficult to go and watch them for the first time, one through six numerically. So what you're saying is true. You go from the science to the faith, whereas, you know, how we view them and much of society has viewed them has been from the faith to the science. I'm going to make the prediction that the word midichlorians will never be mentioned again in this universe going forward. If, you know, the people who are protecting this between, you know, Kathleen Kennedy, you know, really kind of taking over the George Lucas role, and J.J. Abrams now with the movie. And certainly, you know, J.J. is not part of Rebels and everything there, but, you know, the synergy that we talk all the time with the Marvel Universe, I think is at play here. And again, to all prepare you, this is a nostalgic slingshot for the next 15 months heading into that new movie, which is going to be enormous.
Much like Ezra's energy slingshot thing, which is my only, I think, complaint, that it's a slightly too kiddish. But Pete, looking forward, what are your hopes for the series, for this first season, and perhaps beyond?
If you're going to tease the formation of the rebellion, then, you know, I really look forward to bringing together all of these, you know, if not races, ideas of a ragtag bunch to position, you know, a Princess Leia with the plans to the Death Star to help out. You know, there's a line, you know, that's a misstep in this pilot where, you know, Ezra gets off the Ghost into the Star Destroyer and runs and tells them it's a trap, and he doesn't say it right because he should say it's a trap. No, it's trap. You know, but we had the Mon Calamari, the Admiral Akbar, you know, race in Clone Wars. We even had Captain Akbar show up, you know, bring as many of those callbacks and even some new ones, given that, you know, the only Mandalorian we ever saw in the original, you know, five and six and really just five and six when they were unaltered, was Boba Fett. So, you know, what happened to the Mandalorians? You know, there's so much teasing of, you know, the downfall of that proud and prosperous civilization. So I think there's a story to tell there, given, you know, Sabine's kind of sad tale. How about that we've never seen whatever Zeb is as far as his race? And again, you know, that the Wookiees helped him out and everything there. You know, we see very few Twi'leks. You know, the slave girl in Jabba's palace, Ula, as her name is. You know, so I'm really looking forward to that. What I don't want young Han Solo. I don't want, oh, we were on Tatooine and there was a toe-headed kid at Tashi Station who, you know, we got a feeling about. You know, make it separate. Let it be its own thing. Don't make the universe smaller. Make it bigger, but with, you know, some really great callbacks to what we have. I'm interested in exploring the relationships between these characters, and I'm interested in where the bad guy goes. Possible, you know, we might get some Darth Vader stuff. The Emperor, who knows, remains to be seen. But, you know, I'm looking forward to this being its thing here and seeing how it plays out, much like with the Clone Wars. And, you know, if they can recreate that, I'll be very happy.
Absolutely. I think it's a tall order for it to compare to the Clone Wars, particularly since Clone Wars had this, I'll use a phrase that doesn't exactly fit, you know, fit the Star Wars universe, but is apropos to our universe, kind of a multinational take. You know, sometimes you're on this planet, sometimes you're on that planet, sometimes it's political intrigue, sometimes it's, you know, crime boss. Sometimes it's terrorism. Sometimes it's, you know, quasi-religious. I think that worked for that show. Did that possibly also contribute to declining ratings? Because there was a bunch of 10-year-olds that are like, wait, what's an analogy versus an allegory?
The poisoned tea Mandalorian world episode, anybody?
Right, right. So, I mean, bottom line, this doesn't need to be as broad to be just as good, to be a lot of fun. And I think that that's, it's okay if it's just a lot of fun and it's your basic good versus evil type story. That's what Star Wars oftentimes is, you know. So I hope that indeed we do get the full 16 episodes that have been discussed. I hope there's an early renewal. And that maybe the show even goes, maybe this goes 5 or 6 years, you know, before they move on to some, the next animated thing, which takes place between Return of the Jedi and Episode 7, Into Darkness.
Yeah.
That's not the title. The title's not going to be Into Darkness. Star Wars Into Darkness.
It's Star Wars Episode 7, Into Darkness.
Oh, okay. It is a time of great darkness. Darth Vader has returned, but we're going to call him John Vaderson until the big reveal. I used to live on Tatooine as well.
Wow.
Anyhow, Pete, let's keep this this big speeder train of boxes rolling. Pete, hopefully everyone who's listened to this has enjoyed it. And weekly, where can people hear us, Pete?
Well, Fantastic Geek and our family, family of podcasts. You know, the flagship, of course, being the Pop Culture Podcast, but weekly and just started back up this week, we do an Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We did the first episode of the second season last week. We're looking forward to doing that. As I said before, we will do Agent Carter when that comes, and then the Netflix Daredevil show. So you can certainly find us doing that either on fantasticgeek.com or by searching Fantastic Geek on iTunes.
Indeed. Yes, Fantastic Geek on iTunes brings up the whole McGillicuddy.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Pete, looking ahead, you know, New York Comic Con is now, what, 2 weeks away?
Yes.
Any news of Star Wars Rebels being there? As I recall, wasn't Star Wars Rebels there last year?
They were kind of there. It was actually we had to make tough choices at New York Comic Con last year, and that was a presentation we chose not to go to, but only because we had the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Panel followed by the Walking Dead panel. So the two biggest panels at the entire show to go to. They were there. I very much anticipate they're going to be there this year in a larger capacity, certainly from a promotional standpoint. And the show premiering as it will, you know, a week, less than a week out from, you know, that trade show. I don't have anything official on a panel or anything as of now.
Pete, my sources tell me that there's going to be not one, but two Star Wars panels, the second of which a little bit less exciting, The Future of Star Wars Publishing. So that's nice. But on Saturday, October 11th at 5:45 p.m. on the Empire stage, which is kind of the number two stage of the whole shebang there, will be a Star Wars Rebels panel. They're going to have a series star Vanessa Marshall as Hera, as well as Lucasfilm's Pablo Hidalgo, yes.
who's one of the keepers of that story group. And he was there last year, actually.
So that's the same room that they were in last year. How about this? Saturday evening, really awesome. Means you're up against, you know, the Daredevil panel and the Walking Dead panel. So clearly this is meant to play second fiddle to that. And I think that's okay. But, I mean, that's a pretty plum spot there. Saturday evening at the second biggest stage as an alternative to the biggest show of all 4 days, you kind of couldn't ask for much more for a new show.
Definitely. And, you know, while we're going to be stretched kind of thin, getting to all of those various presentations, you know, and the show's got to go on in a couple different rooms. You know, it's good that they're there, and I think it's an excellent sign going forward.
Certainly is. By the way, another excellent sign of things going forward would be you, dear listener, making sure that you visit fantasticgeek.com. That's fantastic with a PH. It's not just podcast stuff. We have articles from time to time, as well as polls. In fact, Pete, maybe after the official air date of Star Wars Rebels, we'll throw a poll on up so people who've seen it either on the app, on the website, on their Apple TV, or actually, you know, on oldie-fashioned turn on your TV at a certain time, they can all tell us what they think about Star Wars Rebels, and we can share it with everyone soon.
Definitely.
With that, Pete, speaking of sharing, you have so many fans. How can those fans get in touch with you?
Well, you must be referring to the Twitter, Matt. You can find me on Twitter at Peter, P-I-E-T-E-R, J, Ketelaar, K-E-T-E-L-A-A-R, 4,222 followers. Can't be wrong.
Wow. Impressive. Ever, ever growing. I am personally on Twitter as Looking Back Lost. You can get in touch with the podcast by visiting the aforementioned Fantastic Geek, Fantastic with PH. That's the Twitter, the Gmail, and the .com. With that, Pete, I know I will be talking to you again before too long. Our next podcast will be in a few short days when we discuss the next exciting episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Indeed.
So with that, Pete, I will say arrivederci to all our listeners, or whatever the Twi'lek version of that would be, probably like... And I will give you the final word.
First time you've met a Jedi, sir?